Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Two Adoptive Mamas podcast. Before we let you press play on our first ever live recording, it's Sarah and Liz here, and we just wanted to say thank you for being with us for 100 episodes. Can you believe it, Liz?
I'm so excited that it's 100 episodes, and we've done a couple bonus ones along the way, but this is our official, like we've had guests and other people, or a content specific, 100 episodes. And I can't believe that it's been 100. So we're really, really grateful for all of you, who have listened in and joined us on this journey. We hope that you have gained community resources, and maybe just validation, that you're doing an amazing work and that you've got this.
Absolutely. When we started off, we said, let's give it 10 episodes and we'll see where we land. And it's hard to believe that we have done 10 times that. So here's to 100 more and enjoy the show.
Wherever you are in your adoption journey, we are a community centered around love, trust, and respect for the experience and opportunities that have made us families.
We promise to share, encourage, support, and celebrate the day-to-day of adoptive mamahood together. I'm Liz.
And I'm Sarah.
And together, we are Two Adoptive Mamas.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Two Adoptive Mamas podcast. Really excited to have you here. Thanks for popping in your earbuds wherever you are at and wherever you are listening from. This is really special.
Yes, it is.
So I think we've made it because, I mean, if this is as big as it ever gets, we've made it.
We're not in sweatpants.
We're not in sweatpants. I usually record in a closet with a baby monitor.
We normally only use the free Zoom, and so we're often telling our guests, oh, I'm so sorry, we have to switch to the new link.
We've had
now
some really well-known guests that we've had to say,
really
can
awkward
you just go back into the same link and we'll keep recording. And there's a cheese platter tonight, so.
I know. Grown-up charcuterie, woohoo!
This is for real. But anyway, welcome to the podcast. It's not just Liz and I tonight, we have four special guests.
This is also our largest panel ever, which
yes,
is great.
Our only panel, our largest.
Our largest conglomerate of people.
We've increased exponentially. So Liz, go ahead, why don't you introduce our guests tonight?
Yeah, well, I'm only going to say their names, and then we'll let them introduce themselves. So to our lovely and wonderful panel, if you could let us know how you are connected to the adoption and foster care community to start us off, and then we'll dive into our conversation. But we have Holly Harden, Eleanor Deluski, Michelle Campbell, and Rosie Mann. And this is not normal, Sarah. I'm not looking directly at them over the screen. So I'm going to start over here to my right. And Eleanor, if you could share with us a little bit about how you are connected to the adoption and foster care community.
Yeah, hi. My husband and I were foster parents for 12 years. We've parented 13 children. We have 5 forever kids, 4 by adoption and 1 by birth. So our kiddos are currently aged 4, 6, 26, and our oldest would have turned 28 this year. We adopted them when they were 2, 4, 13, and 14.
Awesome. Thank you. Next up in our line is Michelle Campbell.
I am an adoptive mom from international adoption, and my daughter has been home from China for 6 years.
Thank you. Rosie?
I'm mom to 5 children. We had 2 by birth, 29 and 25, and we have 3 children. 2 we adopted internationally, and they're both 18, and then our youngest we fostered for 3 years, and he's now our forever child, and he is 15.
Awesome, and Holly?
Hi, I'm Holly Harden. I'm with Kobe's Family Services. I'm here representing the staff, the child welfare staff. I've been in child welfare since the mid-1990s. And I've been with Kobe's Family Services now for the last 15. I coordinate our trust-based relational intervention program, which is evidence-based training for caregivers of kids from hard places. I also have some personal connections. My mother was in foster care and adopted. My sister adopted her 2 sons internationally, and my new daughter-in-law was in foster care.
Awesome, thank you. And we're realizing that even though for our listeners who are listening on the podcast, you can flip back and see that Sarah and I have shared our stories. But we're just going to repeat real quick here so that we can also establish ourselves as two adoptive mamas on the panel. So I have been a foster parent with my husband when we were living in another state. And then now we have two children, both brought home through our international adoption. And Sarah?
Yeah, my husband, Drew, and I have adopted twice domestically. Our daughter is 5 years old, and our son, we actually were just matched and placed with him, and he is 8 weeks yesterday. So we're still going through all the post-placement things there. But really excited to have each of you here today. Tonight is all about community. What is it? What is it not? Why it matters? So we won't ask each of you to answer every question, but for this one, to start us off, could each of you share just some brief thoughts or even keywords on what is at the root of true community for you? And we'll let anyone take the mic literally and start.
I'm never at a lack for words. My feeling is when I really put some thought to this, when Liz and Sarah said this would be the topic, I thought a lot about community and seeing it as not just a gathering of people with common interests, which is basically, if you look at the definition of a community, is what it is. But a community, I believe, is it's more than that. If you want to really say you're in community, then it's an experience. It's a feeling. It's a place where you can be vulnerable, where out in the world, in other places, that might not be possible. And that's what I really feel, that it's just, there's a commonality, but without that other layer of being able to feel safe with the people that you're with, that really defines a community.
I'll speak next, but that was, I like that better than what I said, Rosie, that safety aspect. I just think of it as people share an environment, a purpose, goals, a reason for being there.
Okay, for me, when I was thinking about it, was that it's a place where small talk doesn't have to happen, but you won't be judged for what you say, and you'll be met with support.
I think I thought about it in a very similar way. When I think about community in adoption, I think about it as the place that we can be our authentic selves. I feel like we put a lot of faces on in the world, and my adoption community is the one place I bring my real self to. And that's what I was thinking about when we were talking. There's no small talk. I mean, we haven't seen each other in person in a long time, at least a year. And I think we skip past the small talk and we go straight to the real. And I feel like I don't get to do that in many places other than my adoption community.
I would echo that. Yeah, I would echo that. So we are recording this episode post-COVID, and I think it is a good thing for us to consider how COVID has potentially changed the landscape for a community, and maybe it hasn't, and maybe it has. And so just posing that to our panel, how would you say that COVID has changed the concept of community, if at all?
My daughter just went through some significant medical needs this summer, so we're still living in a COVID world. So I can speak to this a little bit from COVID's helped us a lot with connecting virtually is not this abnormal thing. There's different apps you can use. There's different ways you can watch TV together. There's different things you can do on FaceTime. And the creativity through COVID has helped us when we're continued to be in a state of isolation and unable to be in the community. Outside of our house, the community has come into our house, specifically for my daughter, who at the age of 8 still needs community, and there's a lot created for kids, I think, that wasn't there before. And I think for adults, for us, it's just everyone kind of understands a little bit more of what we're going through because everyone had to do it during COVID.
I was talking to my son's teacher, one of my 18-year-olds, and we were talking about lunch. And she said to me, oh, can Ian go without his aide? I said, sure. And she said, well, he sits by himself. And I said, well, why is that? And she said, well, everybody in his class, he's in a life skills class. She said, everybody in the class sits by themselves. She said, they had to do it during COVID, and they just keep doing it. And they won't sit with each other. So I think that COVID kind of made some people, it made them realize how important community and belonging is. But I think there's also a layer of it that it's kind of been saying being close is not safe. Being together is not safe. So I think there may still be some of that piece that some people are holding on to. And virtually it is, so many things have come up that are so great virtually, but I think that being together face to face, it has a different layer. My background is neurological work. some of you may know I've worked with people. So I, from my perspective, the nervous system picks up lots of different cues of safety or things that are safe or not safe when you're face to face that sometimes are lost virtually, and picks up a lot of threat. And I think, you know, that really struck me that these kids are still sitting by themselves, each of them at a separate table. And how many of us are doing that as adults, but not consciously in protecting ourselves?
You raise a great point, Rosie. And as we continue this conversation, you know, each of you defined community. I heard experience, safety, shared goals, met with support and not with small talk, and authenticity. And so then if you look at the definition of loneliness, it's a state of mind where the human contact we crave seems out of reach, leaving us feeling empty and disconnected. So let's dive into a little bit of the paradox of isolation and loneliness in adoption and foster care in that community, and the strength of community with people who get it. How have you seen this in your experience?
I'm going to specifically call out Eleanor, because you talked about how you like just went right for it and you feel you can be your authentic self with the adoption and foster care community. But that means then that you don't necessarily feel that first with other communities. Or am I putting words in your mouth?
No, okay. I don't think so. I think when you're parenting children from hard places, there's a lot of things we don't say. You know, the things that are not polite to say, and people ask how your kids are, and you're like, well, we're doing soccer, and we're doing ballet, and you don't talk about the, you know, but to get to soccer, we had to get past the food insecurity issues, and it took 45 minutes to get our shoes on because we had to have five tantrums and chase them around the house, and the parts of our lives that are not pretty. And I think the parts that are scary and sometimes really lonely as a parent, parenting kids from hard places is often really lonely. And I feel like the only people I can really talk about it with who really get it are other adoptive parents, because they've either had a similar experience or they know where it's coming from. Where other people look at my children and they're like, well, he's six, why isn't he doing that like a normal six-year-old should? And other people who know he's adopted, who know some of his story, or just know that he comes from a hard place, they don't make the same expectations, and I don't feel like I'm judged in the same way for him not acting like most of the other six-year-olds around him. I feel like I also do a lot less explaining. I feel like when I'm in the world, I do a lot of educating. I do a lot of, this is what trauma does to your brain, let's talk about it. And then people really want me to just stop talking because they want to talk about soccer and ballet, and I'm like educating them on the neurobiology of trauma. And we're in different places.
When I think of loneliness, I think of, again, I go to, we as adoptive and foster parents spend so much time trying to be in that relationship with children from hard places, and we put so much energy into that and receive nothing back. And when that happens, we can set ourselves up for going into blocked care. Is everyone familiar with blocked care? Yep.
Why don't you give us a quick definition? Just
basically what happens is our brains, want to be in connection with another person. Our nervous systems want to do that. That's a human drive. But when we exhaust ourselves in putting all this relational attachment out and receive nothing in return, our nervous systems say, I don't like this. I don't want to be in relationship anymore. And as much as we want to connect with our children, it becomes extremely difficult because our nervous systems are now protecting us from getting nothing from the child. So I think about when we spend so much time like that and our nervous system becomes so afraid of putting ourselves out there in relationship and receiving nothing back, that's a very lonely place, because that doesn't just affect your relationship with the child or your children, it affects all the relationships, because your nervous system starts to see all relationships as, is this just something that's going to take from me and I get nothing back? So I think it becomes really difficult sometimes to even believe community exists when you have so much loneliness inside you just from being in those hard, hard relationships with your kids. So I can speak from my own perspective, is I think that's happened to me. Where sometimes I feel like, is there any place I can go and actually make myself vulnerable? And will that be okay? Because you can't make yourself vulnerable at home.
We do classes, the TBRI classes, and this morning I was with a group of foster parents. It was our eighth week, so they got to know each other. And I think it's because it was the last night, some of the moms were just, and the dads, were really opening up and just pouring their heart out. And to sit and watch how the other foster parents just kind of wrapped around them and supported them and normalized those feelings. And I felt like they all just walked out of there lighter. They exchanged numbers with each other. And it's just beautiful to see that in action, how human beings can step up for each other and how difficult it is to even allow yourself to go to that place with other people.
Thanks. So I think we have a list of questions here, but we're going to combine some of them. And I would just love to hear, if you're willing to be vulnerable, what are some ways or things that you see right now in your current season where you're experiencing loneliness or isolation? And then how do you practice self-care, or what things do you do to feel less lonely?
In my current season, where being in community, I find it hard right now. And I feel like community becomes a lot of work for your nervous system when you're so empty that it really becomes a lot of work. So a lot of what I do is a lot of this relational work, the work we do with our children and within our families, you don't get to see progress. It's not there. You can't hold it and grasp it. So what I find that I do is I go do things like today I went out and sanded a table. Because I could see it change color. I could see it. I mow the lawn because I can see the lawn getting cut. I trim bushes and people drive by. My husband comes home and he's like, you had a really crappy day today. Those bushes really felt it. You know, you can, depending on how severely the bushes got pruned. So that's what I try and do. I try and do things where I can actually see I have a positive impact. I can make a change in something when the changes that occur in our children are often so subtle and so small and hard for us to grasp a hold of.
I think in our season, I feel lonely when there's more people versus less people in our circle, because there's a lot more explaining to do and the emotional and mental toll that takes on you. So our self-care is really limiting the amount of people that we communicate with on a daily basis, because then those people get it and there's no explaining that has to be done when our circle is a lot smaller. So it seems counterintuitive to limit the amount of people you talk to, but specifically when we're in the hospital, we had like 20 people that we told every day what was happening, not, you know, 200 or whatever. And those people were praying for us and we were real and raw, and that was all that we needed, were just those people to understand what our day-to-day was like the best they could, versus me having to re-explain it and re-explain it and re-explain it over and over. So limiting the amount of people, but making sure that we have a safe circle around us.
I heard your question, I was like, I feel like I say no to more than I ever did before. But I think that is the self-care that I need, and we prioritize real, true relationships over, like, all the stuff. Especially coming up on the holiday season, you know, there's a lot of invites, there's a lot of things to do. I have kids with sensory needs, I have kids that get overwhelmed very quickly, I have kids with food issues, and I know the holidays bring all of it up. So we said no to almost everything. But I think I feel less lonely when I'm with the people that I know understand us and that I don't have to explain to. It's a lot of explaining. My kids have vastly different needs, and so I feel like I spend so much of my time otherwise talking about why and how and what we're up to, that I appreciate the times that we can have semi-normal conversations with people that are not about why my kids are acting the way they are or why we have masks on when everybody else doesn't or whatever it is that makes us look a little different. It's counterintuitive, though, because I think, for me, less lonely is in a smaller group of people and maybe with less frequent interactions, but they're real when they're there.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of themes here of just figuring out how we can get, so getting back to Rosie's point about relationship and finding the truth and meaningfulness of that in our sphere of influence, right? And so, like, defining what our sphere of influence looks like and how the community is relating with us and our family and our us as an individual, but also as a family, I guess, is what I'm trying to say, matters a lot. And I think I'm going to use that to pivot our conversation for some just strategies and tips for how we can deepen intentional community within our sphere of influence. And I'm saying that for the group here, but also for our listeners who maybe aren't in an area that is well-resourced. We are fortunate to be in a spot where there are support groups, there are opportunities, and we also, again, live in a post-COVID world where our virtual connections have kind of exploded, right? Like, they were growing pre-COVID, and now they've just exploded. I'm a member of far too many Facebook groups where I could, at any moment, on my fingertips, talk to people across the world who are dealing with things that I'm dealing with, but again, they're across the world and through my phone. So we're going to try and dive into a couple different aspects of this as we kind of help you, our listeners, experience and think about how you might be able to deepen community, whether you feel like you already have it, whether you feel like you're struggling with it, or maybe you feel like you can't find it. So the first thing we want to talk about is how you define your expectations, and thinking about what expectations we really need to consider, whether that's who is the community for that we're trying to build, what are our boundaries when we think about building that community, before we enter into that space, before we get vulnerable and show our real authentic selves, we kind of have to do a little bit of work to decide what it is that we're looking for and what we hope that community to be. So any thoughts on defining expectations and how we can kind of start interacting with that sphere of influence we have?
When I think about expectations, I think about if there's someone genuinely in my community that's, we're really connected, there is no expectation of reciprocity of any kind. That if I send a text out and the text just says, hey, I love you, there's no expectation that there will be a response. And the same thing, if I get a text and things are just way too hard, I know there's no expectation that I return the text. It's just be without anything else. and I will send to you without an expectation of anything. So it's that just knowing.
Well, let's go to the next part of community. That was great, Rosie. I think that, I mean, we've already talked, you know, indirectly a lot about defining expectations. So like Eleanor and Michelle, you shared that sometimes less is more. And so I think, you know, you have to decide. Sometimes when we just say the word community, you think, oh, this is like a thing I have to go to and contribute to and be a part of. And it's like this huge commitment. And I think that's where we need to peel back the layers and say, wait, what is the community for? What is the purpose of this? And how exactly are we interacting? So let's talk about the next piece here, and that's leveraging technology. And we've already touched upon community in a post-COVID world. But how do you use technology to make community connections? Many would argue, and I would agree with, you know, we talked about the face-to-face and how important that is, you know, neurologically. But how can virtual groups help? Can they contribute to loneliness? You know, do we need to be careful there? How can they be used to make local connections? So talk to us a little bit, if you are part of a virtual community, how have you considered them to be part of your connection points, you know, to be able to kind of broaden your foster and adoption community?
I believe that there's some sense of safety in a virtual community, because when you're face to face, you're being read by another person, your body posture, your facial expression, all that. Whereas when you're virtual, you can turn that little screen right off. And if you're gonna make nasty gestures or faces or whatever you need to do, you know, whatever, there, I think that creating a virtual world actually serves a great number of people who might be too unsafe in themselves to be vulnerable in a face-to-face place. But if they can hear other people and other people express the same hardships and challenges and joys and pleasures, and while remaining a little anonymous, I think there is a space for that. Well, that creates a safety that won't come from face to face.
I think that can be a two-sided thing, though, because in that safety and anonymity, I think you have to be very secure in trusting yourself and being careful with taking everything that people tell you to heart. I've left most of the virtual communities I was a part of because they've become very, I even know what the word is, toxic places where people share vulnerably what they're going through and they ask for help and they don't receive help. They receive judgment and criticism and comments that really attack. I've become very careful about only being a part of virtual communities where there are also people I know in person, or they're people who are accessible in person, so that I have some sense of safety that if I share something, I'm not going to be attacked by 200 people all over the world who have lots of thoughts on how I should do it.
So. I think that speaks really well to what Liz said and what you said about what is the purpose of the group. What is the purpose, and why are you there? And I think just like some people are safe in hiding behind it, other people feel emboldened,
yes, they do.
To let out some of their negativity where in person they wouldn't necessarily do that. So again, the purpose, I think, of the group is more important when it's virtual.
I think making sure you just read about the group, or at least watch what other people are saying before you are vulnerable to share, because if you're in a vulnerable place, I would suggest looking through first, because, I mean, I'm in like a bearded dragon group, and people have like fierce opinions that they go after each other on like UVB lights. And I'm like, this is an extensive, angry, bitter conversation about UVB lights. So I'm scared of what they say to each other about behaviors in children who've been adopted. So when I talk to people and they say, which group should I join? I'm like, just whatever group you join, read the whole comment section first and decide if it's the right group where you're safe to actually ask for advice. There are some great groups out there, but I think it's just being cautious with which ones you're in.
I like what you said too, Eleanor, about being part of a group that you already know each other, or you know they are accessible in person. I think that's good to keep in mind that as you build your community, you know, when you're not able to make those face-to-face connections, if you can give each other the latitude and connect, you know, in the in-between times, that was a great point.
I'm going to put Michelle on the spot, but I asked her before I got up to the mic, so it was kinder. I think just given the season that you are in, you have used technology, not just a virtual group, but used the concept of technology to stay connected. And I know that's unique to your specific family situation and medical circumstances, but I also think that there are some really awesome strategies that we can view technology with a different and you and your family have used technology to connect to people. To Eleanor's point, like, you know them, you can connect to them in person when you're able. And so just, I was wondering if you could highlight like how you have used technology as a tool rather than maybe something to hide behind
From like parent standpoint, we're a part of an online community for adopted children with the same diagnosis as my daughter. So when we're in the hospital at midnight, I can be like, hey, what's up with this? I don't like these numbers today. And then I would have like 10 people be like, it's okay. Or maybe they're in a different time zone, or they're also up in the middle of the night with their child in the hospital, whatever it might be. So we felt the connection of like specifically tied to what we were going through in that moment was I couldn't necessarily reach out to like the rest of my community because they would really have no idea what all of these letters and numbers mean. But we had specific people that could understand that in the moment. For our daughter, for creating community, some of the things that we did was make sure that it wasn't just like a FaceTime date, but it was like we had purchased and sent the same materials to the person on the other side of the screen. So we were doing Legos on the other side of the screen. So we were doing something together from apart. Or we played Yahtzee, or we played we made slime together, but everything was identical on both screens, so we weren't trying to like share materials, so to speak, over this virtual platform. But it really gave a communication point, right? You're 8 years old in the hospital, what are you really gonna talk about? But also gave them something to do and a memory. So it wasn't just a conversation, it was then later we have this memory that we can go back on, like, oh, you know, one of my daughter's friends, I remember playing Yahtzee with her in the hospital, and then now we're home and we're doing virtual play dates, and they'll be like, do you want to play Yahtzee today? Because I know we did that before. Or do you want to play Pictionary? Because we also did that before. Do you want to make slime? You know, they have all of these shared memories so that when we go back into in-person community, there's something to hold on to. It's the relationship has continued. So sometimes in the hospital it would be like, I'm going to talk to you while I'm outside for 10 minutes because someone needs to see that I'm outside. And then coming home, just to have that community that was walking it with us, even though they couldn't be there in person with us, but they actually saw, you know, the building that I was in or where we were in that moment. And then later I can be like, well, do you remember that time I told you X, Y, or Z? Let's do that. So it's that shared memories through a digital platform.
All about relationship.
Yep.
All right. We're going to highlight our third point, which would be like looking local. And specifically for this one, I'm hoping that you all would be able to give our listeners some ideas. If something is not readily available, how can you look local and without getting overwhelmed, try to create or make a connection that can provide this face-to-face, local, in-person relationship?
I think it sounds like a scary thing to start an adoption group because, you know, I think there's like an expectation. And I think we put a lot of expectations on ourselves, like we're going to do dinner and we're going to have stuff for the kids. And I think there's this expectation that, well, now we're going to have a really nice dinner and I'm going to show off. And I think it comes back to the same expectations. Like, we've met adoptive families before, and I'm pretty bold about being like, you adopted, I adopted, we should hang out. Like, our kids look the same, we should just play. But I always set the expectation really low. I'm like, we're just going to order pizza and they're going to destroy the house while we talk. Is that okay with you? Like, I'm not going to cook. I'm probably not cleaning my baseboards. It will probably be destroyed. I may or may not do my hair. And so I think it's the same thing. It's the setting the expectations and just bringing people together. I don't think it matters if you have, like, pretty appetizers. I think what matters is having people together, and as long as everybody's in the same place with expectations. And I think it's worth traveling to. I mean, the adoption group that we're a part of, people travel for a ways. And I think we've kept doing it for, I mean, our youngest was just born, so it's been 4 years we've been going, and we'll travel an hour or more to get there, and there's plenty of people that do that. So I think even if it's not local, like literally next door, I think it's worth finding local-ish.
Liz is writing me a love note. This is another part that we would edit out.
I see that. It's making me nervous because I'm talking and she's writing.
Oh, she's not. She didn't write your name on it.
Like, oh God, what she said?
I'm going to let you ask the question instead of writing me a note.
I took all the time to write it out. All
right. Go ahead.
So, ooh, hold on.
Normally when we're on Zoom, we can chat about these things while we're talking.
Eleanor, I think you bring up a really great point, and I also think we've highlighted a couple things throughout our conversation about how we can really let our guard down with people who get it. Let's think about the listener who is in a space where maybe there aren't a lot of people who get it. What advice or strategies would you give to encourage that person to make community where they are? Maybe they don't have anybody else in their area who has adopted or is really unfamiliar with it. Are there any strategies or things that you would have them consider, again, without making that feel like, well, you have to explain yourself every single time that you introduce yourself? Not just you, Eleanor. Anyone can answer, but I'm looking at you.
I think the thing is there are adoptive families everywhere. It's just you don't always know that they're adoptive families. I've seen people put, like, flyers up at, like, grocery stores and churches, create, like, little Facebook groups, start texting people they know, and they're like, do you know anyone who's adopted? Mm-hmm. I get the most random text messages from people, and it's because somebody shared my number with somebody who shared my number with somebody, and they're like, we live close and we adopted. Can we say hi? Which I'm fine with. We made some really good friends by random text messages from people I didn't know. I don't know that I've had to look for it really hard because I think it's found us a lot of the time, and maybe because we've been doing this so long. You know, our first adoption was 2010, so I feel like at this point we have a lot of people, but I've seen people get pretty creative in finding other adoptive people, and then everybody seems to find each other and off you go.
Yeah, I think you're right, Eleanor. I think that I'm thinking back on our own experience, and when we adopted our daughter, Liz and I were working together in the professional field, and I didn't know anyone else who adopted, like didn't know anyone. And then Liz started, and then I left for 12 weeks because we adopted. But she was like, we've adopted, and then it was like instant connection, and then boom, here we are today recording with a panel. So, you know, it's just like one thing leads to another. I think you have a good point. And it's just being willing, like, to take that first step, and then you will find each other. So that's a great point.
I found that it's sometimes when you find connection with people, it's connection through struggle, kind of similar struggle, and it might, I'm thinking about the one family that we're really close to. They have, they do not have any adopted children, but they have children that have complex issues. So there's this connection we have with there, and it's just this, all we need to do is your kid's in the hospital, well, I'm gonna send you meals, and I'm gonna send you balloons, and there you go. So there are things that we share, not necessarily from the same origin, but similar experiences. So, you know, that goes again to being able to be vulnerable, being able to just understand. So many times we as adoptive parents are in midst of so many struggles and things, it's hard to see sometimes others that want to reach out and help us because maybe they understand and we didn't think that they would. So I would just say this, that it's find a way to make yourself open to others. I think sometimes that's one of the hardest things, locally or wherever you are, is just to be able to make yourself open to another person's extending a hand a little bit. Because sometimes I think there are hands extended and we don't often notice them.
Just maybe because it's pretty obvious that we adopted. We're both Caucasian people and my daughter is Asian. So it's pretty obvious that we're adopted, which means we stand out in a lot of places. But those places we were asking before were like the hospital. They have a whole, the hospital we go to has a whole entire international adoption clinic. So I'm like, could you share my name? Like, I know you can't share me theirs, but asking your resources. So our adoption agency, where my daughter goes for therapy, just asking people, do you know anyone that's adopted? Because most of the time, your medical professionals do know someone, and also your agency knows a ton of people. So just by asking, and now we're at this point, home 6 years, that people are like, I just got a text from our adoption agency, hey, there's this other family that I really want to connect you with. Is it okay? So now we're on their mind to like connect other people with. But I think it's pretty obvious that we adopted. So I think in the nature of our lives, we're noticed.
I think when you are looking for that connection, though, it's important to try and find the commonality. Because I see groups where they're like, we're people who adopted from foster care. Or we're people who adopted domestically. And it's like we put ourselves into these little boxes. And there's a lot of commonality in our experiences. You know, I think the group we go to, we're the only people who adopted from foster care. And everybody else is adopted internationally, but there's a lot of common ground in our experiences in raising children that were transracially adopted and dealing with some of the same issues. But I think it would have been easy for us to say, oh, this is not the group for us because they're all international adopters and we're foster care adopters. So I think looking for that common ground is important. And I think it's often there when we dig just like a little bit under the surface.
All right, so let's kind of bring this home with our fourth piece of community, and that's creating solutions. So this is not to be overwhelming. You don't have to put on a cape and go start an adoption support group and a virtual community and a mom's group and how can we be solution focused when we're overwhelmed in navigating the day to day? What are we looking for in our community? How is it already happening? What's missing? And how can you join something that is already taking place? So maybe each of you have experienced either personally or professionally creating a solution that has met a need for the unique needs of your family. And so if you could share that, I know our listeners would appreciate it.
I would just like to add, when you look at solution focused, there's a program that was started in Brazil called Integrative Community Therapy. And basically in Brazil, there's very little mental health, very few mental health practitioners to serve very large population of very traumatized people. So they created this program, and basically it was bringing people together, and people didn't realize how many solutions they actually think came up with in their own lives, how many hurdles they've overcome, and how many other people would benefit from hearing how they worked through it. And so sometimes I think that we have solutions that would help other people that we sometimes don't recognize as something that would help another person. So I think that's an important thing to realize, that solutions are not a big, thought out, evidence-based whatever. It solutions are, I made it through the next 5 minutes and this is how I did it. So I think a lot of people need to realize that they can contribute they have so much to offer but don't realize how valuable their input is. And I made it through 5 minutes today by going out and sanding the table, and everybody else was inside. That was my solution.
Yeah. And I can say from a, go ahead. From a class perspective, so I'm in a different place than you are as a staff person, and we run support groups and we run courses, and it can be so hard to get folks to come, but once they're there and they're able to hear from other people and they're also able to help, I think that that's just as helpful to them as hearing things that feed them that they're able to feed others. Mm-hmm. And we do most of our work in a virtual environment. Of course, something is missing when you're not together. However, we're able to reach so many more people than would ever be able to communicate and gather in real life, just because foster and adoptive parents are the busiest people in the world. So if they can just turn their computer on for an hour and get some support, you know, they do find that valuable.
No, I was just going to go to base off Rosie said, because the only thing that came to my mind was, my only solution to our life right now is that I ordered meal delivery service, because it was an hour a day. I didn't have to think about what we were going to cook, and I just followed the directions, and everybody could do it. And I'm like, that is the only way we're surviving, is because I don't have to think for 1 hour of the day. I just have to follow the directions. But sometimes it just sounds so meaningless, but it makes the world of a difference during that hour or 5 minutes that you stand at the table.
Well, thank you for sharing that, because I kept trying to convince my husband we need to hire a chef. Yeah. And he didn't like that idea, but maybe he'll like that solution better.
Thank you for, to our whole panel, thank you for sharing the solutions, the ideas, the concepts, the thoughts, the challenges, and the vulnerability of what it means to be in community and how community matters for us. I think throughout the whole conversation, our themes has been that relationship is at like the foundation of this, and we are designed to be in relationship. We serve a God who has created us to be in relationship with one another, and despite the challenges that come with our particular parenting journey, we know that not only does our community for ourselves matter, but community for our kids, for our whole family as a unit, that we need to be in relationship with one another and with others outside of us. So thank you for all of your thoughts and all of your just heartfelt insights. Sarah, do you have anything to add before we sign off?
I just wanted to add that Rosie, Michelle, and Eleanor have all done one or more episodes with us.
True that.
So we will link it in our show notes. But if you'd like to hear more about their story and their unique expertise, it is all there.
Yes, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
For our listeners, we're grateful that you joined us. For our in-person listeners, thank you for being here. And for all of those who are listening, we're grateful. Remember, you've got this, Mama.
Thanks so much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode or know someone who could benefit from our show, the best thing to do is leave us a rating or review wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We are grateful to be hosting the Two Adoptive Mamas podcast for our fifth season. Learn more about how you can support our ongoing work through our Patreon at twoadoptivemamas.com. As always, it's been fun. Until we meet again, remember, you've got this, Mama.